the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech Podcast. I'm John Still, ExchangeWire's Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by ExchangeWire CEO Rachel Smith. Welcome back to the podcast, Rachel.
Thanks, John.
And I'm also thrilled to be joined by a special guest this week, Joshua Stenberg, Executive Editor of Morning Brew. Joshua, welcome.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. We are all fans of the various brews and looking forward to discussing them all with you later.
Talking about them.
Excellent. First, we are going to do our usual takes on the news, and we will start with Twitter. So Elon Musk has announced the hiring of Linda Yaccarino as Twitter's new executive. He said he was excited to welcome Ms. Yaccarino to the role, adding that he was looking forward to working with Linda to transform the platform into X, the everything app. Musk said that Yaccarino's prime focus will be on business operations, while he'll stay closely connected to product design and new technology. Known as the Velvet Hammer in advertising circles, Yaccarino has been described as ideal for the job by Sir Martin Sorrell. So he's finally leaving the post that he did promise he would do. And Linda Yaccarino has been brought in to help turn around the fortunes. Rachel, I'll start with you. Do you think Linda Yaccarino is going to be able to revive Twitter's advertising business?
Well, she'll have a bit of a job ahead of her because Elon's done a good job of botching it up, quite frankly. Advertising revenue is in a sorry state over at Twitter. So it's not just, he hasn't just sort of decimated the headcount and in the organization, but he's also had a pretty big impact on incentivizing brands to advertise on Twitter, I don't personally know a lot about Linda Yaccarino apart from what you can easily consume online, but she seems an extremely impressive exec. Sir Martin Sorrell, or Sir Marty, as we like to call him here on this side of the pond, his endorsement is pretty high praise. And I'm sure if she's an advertising, advertising in a media business context veteran, she'll already have a game plan of how she wants to attack this scenario that faces her at Twitter. But I think that Twitter as a business is facing a number of challenges, right? And so what I'm interested to see is how this will play out, because I think there's a collision of a few things happening right now that are making it difficult for Twitter. And will she be able to get in there quickly enough? And will Elon be able to get out of her way and out of his own way quickly enough in order to give her some opportunity to really, tackle this particular issue? I kind of think I did a straw poll in the office earlier on of one person, and was also just wondering, even amongst friends and family, who uses Twitter these days. And I just think there's such a wave of discontent because the platform just isn't what it used to be. The proliferation of less moderated content has created a certain type of environment. It's not just a potentially hostile environment for advertisers. It's also a fairly hostile environment for users. And so in an advertising context within social media, it's not just how attractive it might be to advertisers as a platform. It's also what type of a place it is for users and consumers, right? And I feel like those are stats that are not going in the right direction on both counts. So I think she's got a pretty big challenge on her hands.
Yeah, I think there's, the potential for her as an advertising person to come in and to butt heads with Elon is pretty high. Joshua, what do you think about Linda's move? And how do you see it impacting Twitter?
So I'll start off with the disclosure in that I used to work for Linda.
Know her well.
Not directly. I was minions.
Yeah, right.
So I spent a couple of years on the branded content side, and I was hired at NBC to build and run the branded content studio for NBC News from 2016, 17 to 2020. No, 20. Man, my years are all out of whack.
Remember there was a pandemic in there somewhere.
So let me bring that back. I was there from 2015 until 2017. So Linda is, when So Marty calls her the velvet hammer. Like she is a powerhouse from an ads point of view. This is I think a good move for her, as you know, going into the CEO's role. It's also worth thinking about the timing of this, in that one of her boss, Jeff Shell, got fired from NBC. And I do wonder, was Linda passed over for the CEO's role at NBCU, had been having these conversations with Elon and Twitter, and said, you know what, I'm going to go take my shot because I want to be the CEO of a company. Mm. At the same time, when her former boss, Steve Burke, left, and then Jeff Shell came on, again, there's an interesting dynamic there. So now I get into what this means for Twitter, and it doesn't matter that this movie will play out where Elon cannot help himself. This is his company, and I think we have a collective short-term memory as an industry. It was a year ago where Elon was putting out a deck to anyone where he was saying that by 2028, advertising would generate $12 billion in revenue and subscriptions would generate $10 billion in revenue. So when you have that line, and at the same time, ad revenue has been plummeting, subscriptions have not been, let's say, successful. So hiring Linda is, in a way, a tacit understanding that Twitter is a media business. It's an advertising business. Linda has her work cut out for her because no one wants to be around racists and white supremacists and the vitriol and just overall garbage that you see on Twitter, which has been ramped up in the last year. There was a Pew study that came out yesterday, I think, it could have been earlier this week, that showed how Twitter's most active users have not been as active on the site since Elon came on board. And I saw that, I'm like, oh, you know what? Anecdotally, you talk about your straw poll of one. My straw poll of one was, I've been on Twitter now for 15 years. I am an addict. I have not tweeted since December 31st of 2022.
Mm.
I felt I have a hard time being on there. There are other avenues for me as a journalist to explore. There's LinkedIn, which is fantastic for sourcing, for business reporting. And now we're watching this Fediverse, this decentralized social platform, take off, whether it's a specific instance like Mastodon or even what's happening with Blue Sky right now, Jack Dorsey's new thing. There are more alternatives than just going to Twitter these days. It's still a habit. You still go to see what's happening because Twitter is of the moment. So you take all of these things, and for an advertiser, it's good, but you have to balance that. And while, I had one of my reporters did a piece earlier this week about what media buyers were thinking about Linda coming on board, and to a T, they're all excited, which makes sense because they've been working with Linda for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see a clear path ahead of her that allows her to be successful, because the biggest roadblock is her boss.
Yeah, exactly right. You could totally understand people that have worked with her before, like you said, buyers that have worked with her before thinking, great, this is going to open back up the doors to some Twitter, to some Twitter deals. This is going to be really interesting. But if she's got no control over Elon Musk, and Frank, let's face it, no one has ever appeared to have any control over Elon Musk, including himself, then, you know, where's this going to go? Where are these efforts going to go? And he's already, I mean, we just saw another article popping up there in The Guardian that you shared earlier on today to me, John, where, you know, he's made it very clear that he's going to tweet whatever he wants. You know, one of the things that she'd already come out and said quite publicly is that he needs to sort of step back from, you know, from being so public with his personal views if he wants the company to succeed. And he's come right back out saying he has no intention of doing that. So it feels a bit like a poison chalice. But then, you know, I mean, were there not maybe some promises that were made between the two of them? Because why would she have taken the role? I mean, you make a good point there, Josh, that maybe it's because this was her opportunity to be CEO of a company that she may have been, you know, she may have been passed over for another opportunity at NBC. But yeah, at what?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, I saw a clip of Elon on CNBC from earlier the week where, you know, the conversation was, I think the setup was, you know, it was after, you know, it was having to do with Tesla. And then the reporter started asking him about his comments about George Soros and getting into the anti-Semitism. And he's like, well, you can call me a Semite. Thing. And like, what advertiser wants to deal with this?
No, none. None.
You know, like I think that like no matter how strong an advertiser relationship is, like, why does Procter & Gamble, who's been so loud over the last decade about brand safety, how do you all of a sudden say, well, you know, this is okay for us. We'll continue spending, you know, 8, 9, 10 figures with these companies. Like, I just don't see it. I mean, look, I could be wrong. Yeah. And these companies can just, you know, say, you know what, we're going to give, you know, this another chance. They've got the reach. They've got the hundreds of millions of people. We know that the ads perform however we need them to perform, but like, you kind of set yourself into a trap, right? Where how do you say, well, we can't support these publishers because they are against our brand safety guidelines, but yet they have no problems giving money to Twitter?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting what you said earlier as well, Josh, that, you know, from the point of view of being a journalist, there are other platforms that you can be using to push your content out, right, and to try to reach audiences. You know, you've got to imagine that's what advertisers think too. There are other platforms where I can reach audiences. And it's also what, you know, consumers and users are thinking as well. They are literally going to other platforms. And not saying that there still won't be a volume of people there on Twitter, but a lot of brands are going to be asking themselves, well, you know, do I want to reach those audiences anyway, eventually, if it sort of continues on this trajectory?
And it's from a publisher point of view, you know, unless you have a Twitter account in the tens or hundreds of millions of followers, posting links onto Twitter does not drive any meaningful traffic. So it becomes a you know, a cost center, right? Why you're paying for a whole entire team to put links on at for what, right? If you're not getting that return. So I wonder if there's going to also be some kind of reckoning from a publisher point of view when you start to see that traffic from social platforms has become anemic, whether it's from Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. If you are using that as a distribution mechanism, are you getting your money's worth? And I think publishers need to really start thinking about that. Yes, it's good to be there from a brand awareness point of view. It's good to be there from a being part of the conversation point of view. But if you're not the New York Times or the Washington Post in the US, like, you're not seeing a lot of traffic coming from social, which means that you should start thinking about other distribution mechanisms. And if you're thinking other distribution mechanisms and not being on social, and you get granular into Twitter and you see all of the nonsense that's on Twitter, what's the point?
Yeah, 100%. I don't, you know, I just, it's coming across my straw poll of one respondent. His actual words were, it's coming across like too much of a personal toy for Elon Musk. I don't want to be there anymore.
Yeah. And to me, the scary thing is the guy that's trying to push self-driving cars and, take us to plant, like,
no. Look, he's a lunatic. I'm just going to come out there and say it. He's a lunatic. And you know, we could have a whole separate podcast about, you know, the lunacy of Elon Musk. But I mean, yeah, look, as a brand, I would not be trusting my advertising spend in that context. Doesn't matter how great Linda Yaccarino is and what a great track record she's got. Unless I was assured that he was out of the way, I wouldn't be putting my budgets there.
No. It's just not worth it. Right? Like, yes, it's easy and yes, it's cheap, right? He's basically offering, you know, 2-for-1 deals. So any advertiser like, well, you know, if I'm going to spend $10, but I'm going to get $20,000 worth of media from it, Amy, that's a good deal. But again, you know, like, at what cost? Are you reaching the right audience?
That as well.
Right? And like, is if the people on audience, if there's a shift in the kinds of people that are spending more time on Twitter as a brand, are these people that you want to be reaching?
Yeah. And that's one thing that I feel sort of feeds into that point that I made at the start, which is I think this is a bit of an inflection point. A couple of things are converging at the same time. And I think as a platform, it's becoming increasingly irrelevant to a lot of people that were either prolific tweeters or, you know, part of the original crew, like you said, you know, have been using it for 15 years and now just don't use it anymore. In fact, I asked that question as well, and back to my straw poll. Well, what do you use? And the answer was, you know what, like either other social media platforms, but, you know, not a lot of them felt relevant. And the other answer was other messaging platforms, closed groups, closed messaging environments. So yeah, that's your answer. People's habits are changing.
Yeah. I mean, look, I deleted and deactivated my Facebook account in 2018. I found that I was not spending a lot of time on it. I found that when I was there, just watching the conversations on there was just absolutely mind-blowing in a negative way. And then Cambridge Analytica happened, and I'm like, you know what? I don't need to be here.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about Twitter now. I don't need to be on Twitter. And it's also a good reminder that companies come and companies go. Right? Like, it's, you know, it's rare that a company like, you know, take IBM. IBM is as blue chip of a blue chip company as you're going to get. But they are not the same company in 2023 as they were in 1983, as they were in 1963, right? They change, they move from hardware to software to AI to consulting, whatever they need to do for their company. But most companies rise and fall, and you know, we're at the precipice of a new digital age, right? Like we are seeing this transition. This there are so many echoes here of the late 90s, early 2000s. There's a lot of echoes here, reverberations from the early 2000s, right? You're seeing an evolution of the digital space. To me, the question is, what are we going to port over into this new digital age from the last one? We, as a media industry, have historically taken bits and pieces from previous mediums into the new mediums, right? Like, think of, you know, early digital was just taking print and just slapping it onto. Here, same thing from radio to TV. You know, so like, I'm curious on like, what are we going to take with us? And I really hope we don't take display ads.
Or at least not as they are today, right?
Right. Like I'm still amazed that I still get served belly fat ads. Here we are, 25 years later, and I still get belly fat and toe fungus ads, and I'm like, gone.
Yes.
So I would normally try and put a smart segue between the first and second stories in here, but Josh, you've just done it really neatly for me. companies come and go. And speaking of, our next story is Vice Media filing for bankruptcy ahead of its sale. Vice Media, the once fated new media startup, has filed for bankruptcy protection ahead of its proposed sale. Vice said on Monday that it agreed a sale to a consortium of its lenders, subject to a provision that it remains open to higher bids from other parties. The group, which is home to Vice News, Motherboard, Refinery29, and Vice TV, was once among the hottest digital media groups, winning multi-billion dollar valuation based on its property popularity with millennials. So I'll throw this to you first, Josh. Vice. I grew up with Vice, and it was, you know, one of the big hot things when I was first getting into this industry. So what went wrong? How have shifts in media consumption really impacted Vice?
Oh man, what went wrong? That's a book.
It's a big one.
Yeah. I want to, you know, like there's not just one thing, right? So one of the challenges with media companies is when you focus on growth for growth's sake, when you are just trying to scale, because you are told the more eyeballs you get, the more revenue you get, and you couple that with potentially problematic funding, whether it's coming from a VC model that at some point comes knocking on your door saying, hey, we want our money back, we're ready to move, or an equity model that says, you know what, we're going to take this, gut it, and flip it. You take all of these things, and you know, you forget that there is a big difference between traffic and audience. And Vice was really good 20 years ago at having an audience. And I think they forgot that. And I think a lot of media companies forget that. Like, you forget that you have an audience for a reason, and that's what you're focusing on. Vice had a lot of early, you know, a lot of success in the early digital age in their ad model. They were one of the early founders of sponsored content and native advertising or content marketing, working with brands to create Vice style stories. I mean, their creator project with Intel is still one of my classic sponsored content case studies. But there's just so many missteps along the way that, you know, they just kept digging themselves into a deeper and deeper and deeper hole. And after a while, you go from, you know, maybe a half a dozen different types of paths to go down, where you only got one path to go down, and that's the file for bankruptcy.
It sort of felt, sorry, John, were you going to ask me something there?
I was just about to throw the question to you.
It sort of, I agree with everything that Josh just said. Like I always say with our own business as well, we are, you know, pursuing a growth strategy, but it's not a growth at all costs strategy, because that doesn't take you anywhere. And whatever growth you do get out of a strategy like that is usually fairly temporary. So if sustainable long-term business, and you know, this is not just a media business, any business, you really have to be looking at the long game. And as part of looking at the long game, you've obviously got to interrogate what your revenue model is today, what it should look like, you know, as and when you are fortunate enough to grow and get bigger and you know, achieve other ambitions. And I feel like in the early days of some of these media companies like Vice, maybe that wasn't what was at the forefront of minds. Instead, at the forefront of mind, you can sort of forgive them for thinking about it through this lens, was this is, you know, early stage digital content and news and media consumption. Let's just grow eyeballs, like you said, right, Josh? Let's just get more and more and more users onto the platform, more and more content, and, you know, prove how many uniques we can power through this through this media platform, and then the money will come, the money will flow. Because quite frankly, that's what Facebook for a time, right? Before they started selling advertising, you know, and let's not forget those early days of Mark Zuckerberg saying that he hates advertising and that Facebook was never going to show advertising and they were never going to have an ad, you know, ad revenue model. And that's all the business has ever made money off is advertising because it was inevitable. So for Vice, maybe, you know, a bit different. They definitely had their minds tuned into advertising and how they could be monetizing those eyeballs. But they seemed to get stuck on the focus of just continually growing that user base, thinking else follow. And then the second thing is it was about where that user base was coming from, right? So a lot of referral traffic from social media sites. And they may well not have been able to predict, you know, 10, 15 years ago that we would be where we are now, where the popularity of social media platforms is, let's just say, plateauing and competition is growing in social media as well. But the other thing is that, you know, I think maybe to your point as well, Josh, on the fact that they were, and you mentioned it too, John, when you introduced them, saying that this is a, you know, this is a media outlet and publication that you grew up with. They were known for a particular type of content, particular type of kind of raw, challenging, slightly anarchic content, which appealed to the youth audience at the time, which is a set of millennials. Now, you know, I know there's still some young millennials out there, but the British Prime Minister's a millennial. He's like 42 and he's a millennial. So millennials aren't the defining, you know, the new wave of digital media at the moment. I'm not saying they're not influential and obviously they're big spenders, or not big spenders, but, you know, they represent a big proportion of consumer model, et cetera. But I'm just saying that, you know, if that is your thing, speaking to young people, you've got to change that over time because young people mature and get older. And, you know, I think about, you know, it's not necessarily a good commercial example, but I think about a great youth media channel in Australia, which is a radio station called Triple J, which was actually part government funded. So it's part of the ABC or Australian Broadcasting Corporation. But it started out as that kind of, challenge against commercialized radio. This is a youth network, a youth radio station. Well, when I'm back in Australia visiting, I still tune into Triple J and, you know, I'm older British Prime Minister. So it's not necessarily just geared towards that youth demographic anymore. It certainly picks up on that. And it's certainly got a whole different, you know, atmosphere and a whole different language and a whole different, you know, persona because it is still run by young people. And Vice could have done that. They could have kind of, I think, reinvented a little bit their content and their content strategy. Not saying that they haven't tried to do that, but I still feel that everything that you consume that is Vice branded is very Vice. And some of that stuff also is not very fashionable anymore. It's not very palatable. You know, you've got to change the narrative because we don't talk about things today in the same way that we did 15 years ago. And so I think, again, it's a story of a collision of a few things, but the underlying principle is exactly what Josh said at the start, chasing the wrong things for the wrong reasons and staying fixed on that path for too long. And I've got a bit of empathy here because we know of many companies in advertising technology industry. So forget media businesses. Let's just talk about ad tech companies for a minute, which is a lot of what we write about here at Exchange Wire, our bread and butter, that lock themselves into these VC or private equity deals at massive valuations, which may have felt great at the time that you're brokering the deal, but then you're forever locked into meeting these revenue targets. And that means you have to channel down a particular path because you think it's going to get you to that figure. And that doesn't always pan out very well.
No, you know, there's a, you ever see the movie Goodfellas?
Yeah.
Right.
Love it.
So there's a scene where, you know, Henry Hill, the Ray Liotta character, is doing a voiceover after Paul Sorvino's character basically takes over a restaurant. Right. And, you know, he's talking about how, you know, it works out well for the restaurant because they get the protection from Pauly and you get the clientele and you get the business. But then, you know, it comes to the F you pay me, right? Like your dog got hit by a car. Don't care. F you pay me. Your lights aren't working. Don't care. F you pay me. And to me, that's the VC model, right? That's the, at one point, your investors come knocking on your door and saying, well, you're having a bad time. I don't care if you pay me. Mm. And I think that's how this played up. And then what happens is you torch the place.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of these companies are. And look, the ad tech shakeout of the last couple of years has really driven that home. Now, of course, it's starting to pick up again as there's more investment in the industry. As look, there as always going to be space to find a company to slot into the Luma slot, right? Like you can always shoehorn things. But as, again, as we move into a new digital environment where publishers are more interested in paying more attention to first party data, where they are trying to take control over that instead of running through the exchange, we're going to see this play out again in all of the different spokes that connect to that publisher hub, whether it's through the exchanges or through even to a different extent through, you know, the Googles and Facebooks and Amazons of the world, right? Like all of this is connected. And when you are trying to have a model that's predicated on raising money, like there are only so many options in the end.
And you know what? I think something that underscores this a bit without, you know, obviously beyond the sort of specific machinations of the individuals that were involved at Vice and the decisions that were made, there's an element of this that you can't afford to become too arrogant about the position that you hold within a market. And when you've got investors, you know, chucking lots of money at you, it must be easy to feel as though they're doing that because you're something special and you're doing something really great. But, you know, famous saying, pride comes before a fall, right? You just cannot afford to think that that makes you exceptional. And you must always check your arrogance at the door and think to yourself, yeah, but, you know, if I'm borrowing money, A, when am I going to have to pay it back? And B, is it in line with my monthly outgoings? Can I afford this? Can I afford the repayments?
And the thing that I also think is interesting, right? We spend a lot of time thinking about these, you know, digital darlings, you know, BuzzFeed, Vox. Vice, right? Where they all the road leads to the same cul-de-sac, if you will, for these companies. But we forget, again, and I going back to the short-term memory of our industry, it was only 15 years ago that the New York Times was having its own self-reflection. And they went to Carlos Slim and they said, hey, like, and so instead of going through the VC route, they found a billionaire and he was able to get his money back through the shares over the years. But like, or you look at the Washington Post and the Grant family selling it to Bezos, right? Like there's, and I think that is the other thing that I'm very interested in seeing is where you have these entrenched legacy media companies that are basically, they're funded by billionaires compared to the new digital media companies that I guess that are 20 some odd years old that are, they don't have the billionaire owner that, but they do have the VC owner, right? And there's a difference an owner and a renter. The billionaire is the owner. The VC companies are that model is a renter, which also tying back to Twitter, I think is also an interesting thing, right? You've got, if a billionaire owner for Twitter and you take the view of Twitter as a media company, what is the opportunity there? Now, of course, you have to set aside the problematic billionaire versus the benevolent billionaire. Although, you know, one might take the view there should be such thing as a billionaire. but I think it's always interesting to look at how the industry has shaped itself over history to be able to say, what can we do to make it better moving forward? And I don't think that enough people, enough executives take that long view to say, okay, what am I going to say that is going to help me be sustainable, not just tomorrow, but a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know, it's the part of the media that I find both incredibly fascinating, but also incredibly annoying.
Yeah.
And because it's,
yeah.
Because we don't learn.
No, well, exactly. Learn. But I mean, you know, again, we get into a whole separate podcast about how we don't learn because media is not just an example. Others kicking around. Yeah. But that is interesting because just listening to you talk about that and some of those big, you know, legacy American publishers that you mentioned, it's a similar scenario here in the UK. You either have a news, a traditional news brand that has operated at a loss for a long time. The Guardian's a really good example. Now they're not operating at a loss now, which is amazing. That's a really fascinating digital media story there. Mm-hmm. They've got this mixed monetization model where they rely on, you know, advertising revenue and their subscription, which is actually donation rather than subscription, but it's a similar sort of model. But then the other big legacy publishers are owned and operated or owned at least by wealthy individuals or trusts or organizations. And it makes me think, you know, these businesses are so powerful, but they're so important to our society, right? We on this business find ourselves talking a lot about the purpose of journalistic, thought-led, original content and the important role that it plays in our society. And we know that therefore any business that's puts out good quality journalism and has got a strong readership is a really powerful vehicle in society. Yet we've got these really compromised kind of business models attached to those businesses. And most people that run and operate them find it really hard to run them as profitable businesses. And so that's, you know, enter stage left, your billionaire or your VC company. And that's, I think, what's making the world of, digital news consumption and content consumption really interesting, because there's so many people that are now trying to run those businesses from a different point of view. And I don't want to, you know, we're going to get into what you guys are doing at Morning Brew a little bit later, Josh, but it's super interesting businesses that are doing this a bit differently now. Yeah. And maybe taking that long view that we were talking about.
And the balance with all of this is that, and this is a very binary point of view. However, companies exist for one reason: make money, right? Like, if you're not making money, why do you have a business? Now, you could be an entrepreneur, but that's different from what we're talking about, right? So, like, you have to be able to balance that philosophical point of view of what are we doing that's going to benefit our consumer and our case, readers, and, you know, maybe in the highfalutin sense, society, right? With that understanding of, well, you still have to make money, because if you don't make money, you don't have to be able to put out to your readers, right? It is a very tricky knot to navigate. And I think some companies obviously navigate it better than others. And then it makes me think, like, well, what makes them run better? Is it the people? Is it the product? Is it the understanding? Or is it just dumb luck? And it could just be all of the above.
We are rapidly running out of time, but I'm going to just whiz through our third story anyway. So why identity as a valuable marketing tool is at a turning point. A survey out of 1,000 agency and marketing execs has shown that a majority believe user tracking will soon become obsolete, but only 40% are familiar with non-cookie-based options. According to the survey conducted by Augury and IDC, 32% of respondents said that they will change the type of ad tech suppliers they're working with. Among them, 64% stated they will increase budgets towards suppliers that don't rely on third-party cookies or any personal data collection. Yet 41% of all respondents are only moderately or not at all familiar with non-cookie-based targeting methods. Rachel, I'll talk to you first on this one. What models could replace user tracking? You know, we're entering this cookie-less world that is cookie deprecation's coming. And yeah, what's next?
So I think what is next, in truth, is quite a bit of chaos and fragmentation and laced with some panic. I think they'll be in there too, attributed to the 40-odd% percent of people that don't feel terribly familiar with what's about to happen or what measures and tools they should be adopting to navigate their way through this. But I think in terms of what will actually come to bear in terms of practical relevance, I think we're already seeing how that's panning out across the industry. Of course, the adoption of things like identity solutions will continue to proliferate. So both the provision of those solutions from various ad tech and marketing tech vendors and the adoption of those. I think the big question there, though, for me, for ID solutions that are based on hashed emails is, will that continue to satisfy privacy legislators down the line? You know, for the time being, they kind of work, but, you know, hashed email, sort of arguing that a hashed email is actual consent, is already consented, I think can be loose in various environments. And I especially here in Europe, I would expect to see privacy legislators want to get to grips with that in a bit more detail. Coupled with that, another you know, sort of, I would say, tripod of, collision of a few things here coming together is that I think consumers are less tolerant, certainly of the advertising and with that comes targeted advertising. So creepy targeted advertising is, people are more aware of it and less tolerant of it than ever before. They're also more aware of sharing their data and they're wary of it. Of course, I would still say that the majority of consumers in a digital environment will think, I don't want to share my data because God knows who's going to be using it and for what. But, oh my God, I'm just trying to read this piece of content and especially here in Europe, the consent banners are getting in the way. So yes, whatever, have it all. I just want to be able to read this. So I think we're still in the grips of all of that. But I think that's going to change too, because particularly here in Europe, lots of conversation about what those consent banners should look like and how they should be more digestible and less intrusive. That is going to change over the next, but certainly before the end of 2024, I think, hopefully for the better, who knows. Other tools and solutions that I think brands are already experimenting with, brands and marketers are already experimenting with, but quite possibly not enough. Various versions of sort of improved contextual advertising, some of which, though, controversially, are relying on the scraping of data and content from publishers' websites without explicit consent of that. We've chatted about that on the podcast the last couple of weeks, either explicitly or incidentally, and that needs to be tidied up. Right? Like, that, you know, there needs to be a way for publishers to develop direct relationships with those third parties that want to be able to offer their content in a contextual advertising way to reach a particular audience. Publishers need to be really involved in that. There needs to be a closer link between the buy side and the sell side to make that transaction work well, because it will lead to better contextual advertising, number one. And number two, you know, I think I've just had enough of publishers being producing stuff and having others use it to, you know, for their own monetary benefits, right? Like, this, we've got to get a bit more mature about that. And then I think, you know, there's going to be some other sort of ID graphs and ID modeling that will come out of all of this, probabilistic and deterministic modeling, some other, you know, sort of AI powered conversational advertising tools that again rely on contextual signals, and we'll see a combination of all of those things, I think, proliferate over the coming months. But the real issue, and we've been talking about this at Exchange as well and at ATS events, etc., on the podcast, the real issue, of course, is measurement and proving the value of any of those tools for the purposes of reaching audiences. That's the other thing I was going to say. Publishers offering up more specific audience segments and whatever tools and solutions they're using, whether that's whether that's their own first-party data off the back of what they know their consumers and readers are doing, but being able to package up answers either in cohorts or any other word you want to use for it, quite frankly, to actually, you know, be able to offer that directly to advertisers will be a really powerful tool. What that means is a really fragmented marketplace for buyers. So things are about to get all the more complicated and all the more fragmented. But on the tech side, I think quite exciting and innovative, but we've got to get this right. We have to do it from this position that we're in now in the industry of the buy side and the sell side being in closer than they ever have before, to try to make this work a bit better.
Yeah.
I'll pause. now. Stop speaking.
You can breathe after summarizing the industry in about two
Thanks,
minutes. Sarah,
a sip of water. Sorry about that.
Excellent. A classic Rachel Smith rant. I loved it. Josh, I think you probably have a different perspective on the US side with different regulations than we have over here on that kind of thing. But how do you see publishers setting themselves up for the changes? Is the education piece important? And yeah, how do you feel about it?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's funny. So 10 plus years ago, I was a media reporter at Digiday. And over the last couple of weeks, I've been doing the painful exercise of reading some of my older stories to see back to like, what have we learned as an industry? And you could take most of those stories, take out the 2011, 2012 dateline, slap on 2023, and it's the same thing. So I will take the artful dodge in saying, I don't know anything about anything. The only thing that I know is that if a publisher cannot, and this, again, it's a very simple and just very binary, but if a publisher cannot differentiate between traffic and audience, all of this stuff doesn't matter, right? Like, what is your reason for being and build around that? If my reason for being is to write for a specific audience, then that is how I'm going to serve that audience. That is our through thread of Morning Brew. I've got 7 B2B publications. I'm not going for scale. I'm not going for flyby traffic. I'm going for a targeted audience. So if I take IT Brew, right? It's a publication specifically for IT professionals. Parents subscribe to that publication. Great. I'm happy that they do, but they are absolutely worthless to me because they are retired. And they are not in IT. So their eyeballs mean nothing from a editorial point of view and from a revenue point of view. So as we are building out these systems and how we are looking to find those audiences through our tech stack, as a publisher, I need to make sure that I am reaching that right audience. Now, if I'm a generalist and I'm going for that scale play, it's a little bit of a different story. But I also want to make sure that I am getting the right audience that I want to get for that style of story. I'll use the cop out of I don't know. I have no idea. My default answer to pretty much everything is it depends, because there are so many different types of outputs. And then the follow-up is, after you get those inputs to understand what the it is and depends, is always comes back to we're fucked, because companies come, companies go, and we want to make sure that you can be as sustainable as possible. But in today's landscape, it's, as evidenced by what's happening across the board, it's really hard.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And yeah, speaking of, your professional reason for being, at least, I want to move us on to have a little bit of chat about your work at Morning Brew. You said you've got 7 B2B publications, all of which are great reads and have come a long way in a short space of time. So yeah, tell us a little bit about Morning Brew and how everything's going. And in particular, your model, the newsletter service.
Yeah, Morning Brew is fascinating. I love it here. So this company started, I think like 7 years ago, as a way for, our founders were like, we need to learn about finance. So we're just going to read a bunch of financial publications, and we're going to curate and aggregate the information that we think is relevant for us to understand. And they started to build a incredible reader base. So our main publication, Morning Way, things are 4.5 million subscribers. And a couple of years ago, the company said, what if we started to branch out into specific industries? So they created retail brew, marketing brew, and emerging tech brew. Same model, let's aggregate and curate information in those particular industries. But then they realized that there was a little bit of a ceiling there. In order to grow, we needed to start to do original reporting, offer something to our readers that they wouldn't be able to get elsewhere. You could take the digestible format, you can take the tone and the voice of the writing, but now what does this look like if you start to actually do journalism? And they strangely hired me to help. So over the last 2 years, we've introduced 4 publications, HR Brew, IT Brew, CFO Brew, and Healthcare Brew. On the B2B side, we've started to develop other types of consumer-facing publications with Money Scoop and Money with Katie, leaning into an influencer subset. But really, the idea all stems back to, again, is making sure that we have the right audience, that we are writing for people on our business side to be able to help these industries make better decisions. I was at a different trade publication for a number of years, and their unofficial internal motto was like, we want to help marketers do their jobs better. And I always kind of bristled at that because we weren't marketers. So how could we tell marketers to do their jobs better? Right? Like, it's kind of like, how do I tell, you know, a football player to be a better football player when I don't play football, right? Like, it's to me, that's a simple approach. So what we decided to do is, hey, well, what if we can give them, our reader, the information so that they can take it upon themselves to read, digest, contextualize, and say, oh, I understand this, how this company is doing this thing. Let me look at our systems, our processes, our operations, and see how, you know, can this work for us? Or maybe this is a great idea for this company, but this doesn't work for us. But now it's got me thinking, what can I do to move my company forward? And we've highlighted these industries and job professions where we see just so much potential for growth. The HR industry, the IT industry, corporate financial professionals, the healthcare industry. So our philosophy is rather simple. Tell good stories, make sure that they're accurate, make sure that they're the closest thing to truth that we know, and help our readers really navigate their fields and functions in ways that are going to help them hopefully make better decisions. Because at the base level, if... You know, going back to display oak, right? If marketers have all of better information to make better decisions, maybe the next medium that we come up with, we're not going to port display ads onto that.
We are out of time, sadly, but that's a lovely point to end it on. Josh, thanks so much for today. And we wish you all the absolute best with everything with Morning Brew. As I said, we are big fans here at Exchange Wire. And it was a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
And Rachel, thank you as always.
My pleasure. It's lovely being a guest on the podcast.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you on the MadTech podcast next week. Thank you very much.